I think most people are here, still coming through. If anyone's not here, please put your hand up. Which brings me to the subject of today's talk on the third morning of this Easter 2007 retreat. It is solving the difficulties and problems in meditation. You know, why isn't it just so easy and you just go and get nice and peaceful and bliss out? Why do all these problems come into meditation which stop you really enjoying the peace and quiet of the mind? It seems so easy to do, just to let things go, put things down, just watch the breath and have a good time. But in practice, it's not always that easy. And the biggest problem, the root problem, the main cause of the difficulty in meditation is you. This is self and this me and always wanting to control and get things and do things and make things happen. That is a major problem of meditation, the you. Which is why there's a great saying, not by the Buddha, this is in the Visuddhimagga, and I used this for a retreat recently. The main theme of the retreat was to contemplate the saying in the Visuddhimagga, the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. It's one of those great little sayings. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. And when you contemplate that, you'll understand that as long as there is a traveller, then you can't see the path. But when the traveller fades away and disappears, then the path manifests. And that's so true to one's experience of meditation. The more there's a traveller doing the meditation, making it happen, sort of being proud of the results, getting frustrated at the difficulties, as soon as there's a traveller there, then the path disappears. And the more there is a traveller there, the narrower the path, until when there's a real traveller there, it completely vanishes and you can't get anywhere. But when the traveller starts to fade away and disappear, then the path gets wider and wider and wider. The less you're there, the more difficult it is to fall off the path. And when you fade away completely, the path is like this 8-lane highway with no exits, and you just travel along there without any possibility of doing anything else but getting into deep and peaceful meditation. And it's a nice little thing to contemplate, because it's one of those mystical sayings which people don't understand but which they like to think about a lot. That's what we mean by mysticism. When you say these weird and strange little sayings, people love them. And they think it's so profound, usually because they don't understand it. But here you can get some meaning, especially because you're meditating. And the meaning is, you can see the more you get involved in the process, the more you try and control it, the more things you try and do, the more complicated it all becomes. And that saying is just so helpful. The path is, when no traveller on it is seen. So you don't be a traveller. Try and get rid of that idea of you doing the meditation and be more of a passenger. So instead of driving your vehicle, you just sit in the back and let somebody else do the driving for you. So you're not a traveller anymore. You're the passenger. And where that actually comes from is, and many of you have heard these descriptions by me, because sometimes when you understand what's going on, you get some sort of framework to see the whole process. It makes it much easier to understand what's going on. And the framework which I'm going to introduce this morning is one of my favorite frameworks, and I've used it to such a great deal of understanding, to bring such a great deal of understanding into meditation, is understanding the framework of the mind being split into two halves, the knower and the doer. The knower is the passive part of your mind. That what's listening to me now, that which can feel, that which can know, that which can listen, but it doesn't react. It just knows. That half of the mind which receives the data from the senses. The passive knower. And the other half of the mind is what reacts to that. what initiates thought, what initiates action, what initiates speech, moving, or whatever, what I call the doer. The doer is the active half of the mind. The knower is the passive half of the mind. And with that framework, the whole path of meditation is to maintain this knower, mindfulness, awareness, a passive knowing what's going on, but at the same time to quieten down and subdue this doer. So you can listen but not react. You can feel and just know without doing anything about it. That you can even watch the breath, it goes this way or that way. You know it, but you don't react, not in the slightest. You don't do anything. You just know. Because what happens is if the mind is wandering backwards and forwards or thinking or whatever, if you look at it through this framework, that's called the result of old karma. The reason why it's moving about backwards and forwards or thinking or dreaming or falling asleep is because of the causes from the past. You know, something has disturbed you, maybe someone said something, or you haven't had a good night's sleep or had a bad dream, and that creates a thinking mind. So when you're thinking and whatever's going on now, always look upon that as that's the result of old karma. So what can you actually do with old karma? The only thing we do as Buddhists is make sure we don't make any new bad karma. We don't react to this unpleasantness by more causes which will create more unpleasantness in the future. Which is why I say that when you have even negative states of mind coming up, remember that's the result of old karma. It's here now, you can't do anything about it except be peaceful with it. Make peace with it, accept it, be kind to it. And if you can be kind and peaceful to this old karma, it fades away. It is the story in Open the Door of Your Heart, which I'll repeat even though many of you know this, which is a great story from the mouth of the Buddha. It's in the Udana, although I did change many of the details, but the basic story was taught by the Buddha 2500 years ago. The story of the demon in the emperor's palace. And many of you would have known that. Maybe I haven't told it for a long time in Nolamara temple simply because I thought that most people remembered it. Demon in the emperor's palace works like this. There was an emperor who was away on business, and this monster, this demon, this ugly fellow came into the palace. And he was so frightening that all the guards and the soldiers froze instead of trying to do something to keep the guy out. And that allowed the monster to go right into the throne room and sit on the emperor's throne. And it was only then that the guards, the ministers, the soldiers came to their senses. And they shouted, "Get out of there! Who do you think you are? This is not your seat, this is our emperor's seat. Get out!" And at every unkind word, unkind deed, or unkind thought, the demon grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and his language got worse. That really upset them even more, and they got out their swords, they clenched their fists, and they got clubs, and they threatened and threatened and threatened this monster, "If you don't get out soon, you'll be in big trouble." But again, every unkind word, every unkind deed, or even unkind thought, the demon just grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and more offensive. And that had been going on for quite a few hours when the emperor came back. And when he went into his palace throne room, he saw this enormous monster taking up half the room, and it was a big room at that. And he was so ugly, so frightening. Even that criminal, Chopper Reed, would probably faint in fear. He'll make even hell's angels just sort of run for the door. He was so fearsome. And as far as smell was concerned, he reeked so badly that he would make, as I said in my book, a maggot throw up and be sick. and the language which came off him. He was such bad language, worse than even the US Marines when they get drunk in Baghdad on a sort of Saturday night. Terrible language, so smelly, so ugly, and so big. And what did the emperor do? The reason he was so big and smelly was because of the old karma, the bad things which had been thrown at him. So the emperor decided to give him some good karma. He decided to be kind. He said, "Welcome, Mr. Monster. Thank you for coming to visit me. Why have you waited so long to pay me a visit? Has anyone got you something to eat yet, or something to drink? What would you like?" And of those kind words, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, and less offensive. And at that, all the people in the palace realized their mistake. They'd been given ill will, bad karma to this problem. And so they started to change their ways. They started to look after this monster, asking, you know, what does he want to drink? Do you want like a cup of tea? We have English breakfast. We have Earl Grey. We have peppermint, which is good for your health. 2 lumps or 10. Would you like something to eat? How about pizza? Monster size. Someone gave him a foot massage. Another person gave him Reiki. I always try and make this up as I go along and add something new what I didn't say last time. And they were so kind to this monster. Every kind act, deed or thought, it grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And in no time at all, it seemed anyway, he was back to the size when he first came in. But they never stopped. They carried on laying on the kindness, the gentleness, until he got so small. One more act of kindness, and the demon vanished completely away. When the Buddha told that story, he said, "Monks, we call that an anger-eating demon. When you give it anger, it gets worse and worse and worse. Bigger and bigger, smellier and smellier, more offensive, more offensive, more offensive. Now, your meditation. The thoughts, the wandering mind, the sleepiness. How many times when you're really dull and sleepy, you say, 'Get out of here, you don't belong. I'm supposed to be awake. I'm supposed to be alert. This is my meditation retreat.' Or you start thinking those stupid old thoughts. 'Get out of me, get out of my mind, my throne room. Get out of here, you don't belong,' all these stupid thoughts." And of course what happens? The thoughts or the sleepiness gets bigger, more troublesome, more problems. Why? Because you give it bad karma. You make more problems. So whatever's happening in the mind, give it, remember, it's old karma. What you're experiencing now is old karma. Whatever that is. It's a result of past causes. So your job in meditation is whatever you're experiencing now, don't make bad karma with it. Don't say, "Get out of here, you don't belong." Or don't sort of think, "Oh, I'm just so hopeless, I'm so terrible. I've been meditating for 30 years and I still can't keep awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. Oh, I'm so hopeless, I'm so terrible. 3 or 4 days already and haven't got jhana. But everyone else has. Oh, I'm so terrible, I'm so awful. I spent all my days just thinking about fantasies. I'm so terrible, I'm so awful." Now, of course, when you think like that, you're making more bad karma with the bad karma you've got already. And that's why it keeps going on and on and on. So instead, you just say, "Welcome." And if you do it properly, when you make peace with things, the demon, whatever that is, always gets an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. It starts to fade away. Because you're not controlling anymore. You're letting things be. You're being gentle. You're being kind. And that is not doing things. That's letting things go. It's subduing the doer. Because real kindness and gentleness means you're not doing very much. You're just passively watching and accepting and embracing and being at peace with things. Which is why that it works. You're not doing so much, you're letting go of the doer, and you're allowing more knowing to happen. But there's another part of this doing business which is also important, because a lot of times when we do things, we actually generate, you know, what somebody reminded me of yesterday in the interview, they generate a favorite phrase of mine, something which I noticed in my mind, which is a big problem for my meditation in the early years, not just in my meditation, but in my ordinary life. Because when you do things, a lot of times you do things through what we call the fault-finding mind. And that fault-finding mind is one of the biggest problems to meditation. Again, I started off with the core problem, you know, the self, the me, and you know, the doer, which is, you know, most of you, the biggest part of the sense of self, the doer. But why do we do things anyway? Because we think that something needs to be fixed. There's something wrong, there's something, you know, out of line, we want to push it back into line again. We want to sort of sort it out, we want to make it right. And this all comes from the fault-finding mind. And it's interesting to notice, once you've got a word for it, you can see just how often that fault-finding mind comes up. Even the breakfast. You know, we had eggs, I don't know if you had eggs as well, we had eggs, we had cholesterol on toast today. But anyway, I like cholesterol because, you know, cholesterol is the way of stopping the suffering of old age. Please don't quote me on that, I'll get in big trouble. But sometimes people will say, why did we have poached eggs? We should have fried eggs, we should have scrambled eggs, we should have eggs benedict, whatever that is, whatever we're supposed to do. We can always find fault with something. We've got a nice egg and we sort of want it differently, or it's not done boiled hard enough, it's not boiled soft enough. Now, is that fault-finding mind is so common in human beings today. We demand so much because we find fault with it. And you ask yourself, why do I always find fault with things? You know, sometimes, you know, you've got a partner, they're a nice partner, you always find fault with him or her. You got a job, it's a reasonable good job, you find fault with it. You know, you come to a retreat and you look at those bricks and you find fault with the bricks. You know, your business, you know, to find fault with the bricks in this retreat, that's the owner's job. Now, your job in this retreat is just to take it easy. You don't need to find fault. You don't need to manage anything. Or sometimes if you run a retreat before, you can actually find fault with the way it's run. We shouldn't do it this way. We should have, you know, more discipline. You know, get sort of like SS guards to come out in the morning to get you out of bed. I told this joke last time. You see all these crucifixes on the wall? We keep them on there as a warning. A warning, if you sleep in too often. That's what happened to the last person who slept in too often on one of these retreats. Of course, that's just obviously a joke. Please don't run away. But anyway, sometimes we can always find fault with things. And that state of mind, which is finding fault with things, is one of the huge problems of meditation. It is like a part of the controller. It's part of the doing. You know why we want to find fault? Because that gives us a sense of existence. Builds up our ego. Builds up our sense of superiority, that we know better. That's where it all comes from. But you can actually see its manifestation in finding faults. And you can do that with, you know, your breakfast, with your lunch, with your room, with anything in this retreat. And this is a big problem, because whenever you find fault, you'll have some business to do. You'll have a job, you'll have work, and so you don't have any peace anymore. Instead of having the fault-finding mind, its opposite is what we call the grateful mind. You're so grateful just to have an egg in the morning. So grateful to have a wall which protects you from the wind and the sun and all the other stuff, the rain and weather. You're just so happy to have a cushion to sit on. You're so happy just to have a mind. I'm so happy just to be here in this moment, to have the opportunity just to sit still and actually follow the path of meditation. That grateful mind doesn't see the faults anymore. It appreciates this moment. And when you have gratitude to the food you eat, to the bed you sleep on, to the walls which protect you, and the cushion which is underneath you. Then you have this wonderful sense of peace. It's good enough. You're thankful that you're here. And with that gratitude mind, not the fault-finding mind, because there's no more work to be done, then you can be still. You can rest. The work has been done. Enough anyway. So you can sit down and take time off. Otherwise your life is always going to be a journey. Always walking, always travelling, and never stopping, not even for a moment. And why? Because there's always more journey to be done. And we can never be grateful enough on how far we've come to give ourselves permission to sit down for a few minutes. With gratitude, we're not saying it's perfect, but we're saying it's good enough. So we don't need to find fault with the moment. So we can rest. So what that means, we sit down. Sure, your body is not absolutely comfortable. There's always an ache or a pain somewhere in the body. And no matter even the young guys, there's always some ache or pain somewhere. It's good enough. So don't find fault with this body. It's doing its best. And if you have got any pain, some old karma, you don't know what it is, but don't get angry with that. Just make peace with it as best you can. So you're making good karma now with this body. And you just close your eyes. You don't find fault with the moment. You don't think, I've been meditating for one whole minute and haven't seen animity yet. Or I've been meditating for 3 hours and 30 years or 50 years or 100 years. Don't think like that. Don't find fault with this moment or find fault with yourself. But if you find fault with the moment or find fault with yourself, you get into this negativity, you get into being down, you lose your energy. And you haven't got the oomph and the peace which will drive you into deeper meditation. So you know what good karma is, you know, kindness, gentleness, acceptance, peace. So you make the good karma with this moment. And you're just grateful to be here, you stop finding fault with things. When you stop finding fault with things, sometimes people say, well, if I don't find fault with things, there'll be no progress. You won't get anywhere. Precisely. You're not supposed to get somewhere. You're supposed to be where you are. And whenever you find fault, you always have to get somewhere else because this place is not good enough. You're not supposed to get progress going on to the next stage. It's always ingress going into where you are, which is a whole process of the meditation. Once you are content because you don't find fault, you stay where you are. And because you're not finding fault, you're not doing anything, there's nothing to do. Because there's nothing to do, you become still. And the stillness builds up energy. And because it builds up energy, you go deeper into things. You can already see that when you are still, you're not moving into the future or the past. You're still in this moment. When there's nothing to do, there's nothing to think about. When you don't find fault with the present moment or with the silence, when it's good enough, you can stay there. When it's not good enough, you always have to go somewhere else, which is called restlessness. When you don't find fault with this moment, the problem of restlessness is solved. This is good enough. It's good enough for me to rest, to sit down and not go anywhere, just to be. So you don't find fault with the moment. When the breath starts to happen, don't find fault with the breath. As I said last night, when you first watch the breath, it will be a little bit uncomfortable. We always do interfere with it. It's our nature. So don't find fault with yourself and fault with the breath. Oh, I'm stupid. I should be able to do better than this. Don't find fault with yourself and don't find fault with the breath. It's just the breath doing its thing, that's all. So be kind to your breath. Be grateful that you're actually breathing. Some people aren't even breathing. They're over in the cemetery right now. So at least you're breathing. Oh, thank goodness for that. Doesn't matter what type of breath it is. And just be grateful to be awake today. You know, this is Sunday. It's, what time is it? 8:30, there's still many, many people in Perth who haven't got out of bed yet. That's why this is supposed to be the day of the resurrection. At least you've, you know, been reincarnated this morning. Many people aren't even resurrected. They're stood in their tomb of their bed. So, just be grateful you're here. And when you do that, when you're just watching this breath, you feel at peace with the breath. You don't find fault with it. It's good enough. When it's good enough, you can accept it, you can be with it, you can stay with it a long period of time. And you don't want it to go on to the next stage. If you want to go into the next stage, it means you're not content with it. You're finding fault. It's not good enough. I should go deeper in my meditation. That's more fault finding. This is good enough for me. I've just got the breath in mind. That's wonderful. So don't, you know, try and sort of, you know, be this superstar meditator and just get the deepest meditation of all the meditators in this retreat. If you try that, you're going to hinder yourself. That's the problem. Finding fault, not being satisfied. Again, the metta chant we did this morning, being contented and easily satisfied. Not demanding in nature. Being contented. Easily satisfied. Not demanding. No fault finding. That way you get very, very peaceful. Very still. You don't have to move. So future and past disappear. Nothing to say. Have you ever noticed all of your thoughts, 99.999% of them, are all finding fault? Seeing what's wrong and finding ways to fix it up. If you didn't find fault, you'd have hardly anything to say. Look at the news. Look at the newspapers. Look at the soap operas. It's always when there's something goes wrong. When nothing goes wrong, there's nothing to say. So when you don't find fault, the thinking mind disappears. The thoughts just go. Restlessness has disappeared. You just watch the breath. If you don't find fault with the breath, the mind can engage with it. When it finds fault, it has to go somewhere else. When it's grateful for this breath, it stays there. And because it stays there, the natural process happens. You're making good karma. It must be good results. The good results is the breath, you can see the whole breath, and it becomes beautiful. You're not finding fault with it anymore, you're appreciating. Oh, it's just so nice to have an egg in the morning. So delicious. Doesn't matter how it's cooked. So nice just to be able to sit in meditation here. I'm so grateful I haven't got a husband, sort of, ma 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 ma. I don't have to cook for him, don't have to wash for him. That's actually the the story of the, in the Terigata, the verses of the enlightened nuns. And when, if you ever read that, it's got some great little quotes there. And just to show that enlightened nuns had a sense of humour in those days, nun after nun would always say that when they become a bhikkhuni, they always gave up the three crooked things. Some of you know what those three crooked things are. They say, as soon as I became a bhikkhuni and left the world, I gave up the three crooked things. Crooked thing number one was the broom, which you used to sweep the house. That was the first crooked thing you gave up. The simile of, like, housework. You're a nun, now you don't have to do that housework, cleaning up the house all day. The second crooked thing you gave up when you became a nun was the ladle, you know, for sort of tasting the curry. Now that symbolizes, like, cooking. When you become a nun, you don't have to cook anymore. And the third crooked thing they gave up was the husband. So you say they gave up the three crooked things. And they were so happy, they didn't want to go back to the three crooked things ever again. So for all you wives here, you've given up the three crooked things for this retreat. Oh, so wonderful. Yeah, sometimes you have to do a little bit of sweeping or washing up or whatever. Same as the guys as well. Three crooked things, but no, different crooked things. But the point is, we're so grateful I don't have to do anything here. So you feel so happy. Just watching the breath, that's all you have to do. Oh, isn't that nice? Just getting away from it all. The only thing I have to do now is just watch a breath going and watch a breath going out. How more easy could it get? So don't find fault. You find gratitude. And when you find gratitude, the breath becomes so lovely and so beautiful, because you're not finding fault with it anymore. Sometimes that's very close to like loving kindness. Because, you know, monasteries, people often bring their babies. And when I see the babies coming, I say, oh my God, they look really ugly. And I do that because I'm a man, I'm a monk. But you see the mother here, and they're sort of coddling the baby, and they think, oh, it's so nice, and it stinks because it just pooed its pants. Oh, it's so nice. It's amazing just, you know, how a mother can love her child. I could never do that. So if you can have, like, the lack of fault-finding, which must be very difficult when you've got this howling, screaming monster pooing in its pants, screaming all night, if you can love that, surely you can love your breath. It's much easier to be kind to that and have no fault finding. Oh, just beautiful breath. And so you can imagine just holding it and swaying it, breathing in and breathing out, and breathing in and breathing out. When you have that degree of kindness to your breath, oh, it's just so easy to watch. And it looks beautiful, just like a mother looks at their child, and their child is the most beautiful thing in the whole world. Because you've got lack of fault finding. You can do that with your breath, this most wonderful breath, your little baby. And when you coddle it that way, the breath is so easy to watch, you've got no fault finding. And then if the breath disappears and you get the nimitta, oh, you're just so happy to have a nimitta. What do most people do? They get fine fault. It doesn't stay long enough. It's not bright enough. It goes this way, it goes that way. It's not clear enough. Even then people find fault. If a nimitta comes up even for a second, oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to have seen a nimitta just once. You're so grateful. Instead of being so demanding and wanting it to be there for a long time, I want to get to the next stage and wanting to get enlightened and all this sort of stuff. Remember, the path is very easy when there's no traveller. So you're just so grateful. This is so nice. Thank you so much. You just got one tiny nimitta once in the whole retreat. Ah, so wonderful, thank you. When you have the lack of fault-finding, controlling mind, then those nimitta think, ah, you're a meditator I can hang out with. You don't control me. You respect me. You're kind to me. You're at peace with me. Because you don't find fault, you can be still. You can be accepting. You're not controlling. And that means these nimittas and other things, they can come and they can stay. As you go deep in the meditation, the fault-finding mind just goes more and more soft, fades, disappears. And when you have no more fault-finding left, you're at peace. Just at peace with the world, peace with the stillness. You're not doing anything. You're just knowing. The doer has subsided and the knower is all that's left. And the other thing with some of the problems which people have, not just the restlessness, the other problem which you will always have in the first few days of the retreat is dullness and sleepiness. But I keep on saying that dullness and sleepiness, be grateful for that. Don't find fault with it. It's part of the path. Nothing to do with you. It's just cause and effect. It's old karma, sleepiness. Because you've been working hard. Or because, you know, maybe you've eaten too much. Or maybe there's some lack of balance in your physical body, which means you're tired. You know, for years, in the early days of Thailand, I had a great trouble with sleepiness, and I would fight so hard to overcome my sleepiness, and sometimes you would break through the sleepiness, but a lot of times you wouldn't. But when I did break through that sleepiness, I wasn't peaceful. It was always restlessness afterwards. And I'd have to try and subdue that restlessness, and as soon as it was subdued, I'd fall asleep again. And it was such a lot of pain and suffering for me, fighting that sleepiness. Only now I realize just how stupid I was. Because in those days I was a person who was brought up in London, sort of in cold and cool climate, well fed. And now I was in this very hot tropical jungle. Now the temperature was, my body was not used to. It would have to make you sleepy. and you're getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're only supposed to sleep 4 hours at night at most. So I was sleep deprived. And the food we had in those days was very poor, so even I was malnourished. Now if you think about that, malnourished, sleep deprived, in a hot climate, what do you expect? Nothing to do with me, it's just physical stuff. So when you actually understand what's going on, you understand it's just cause and effect, that's all, nothing to do with you. So I was stupid to fight it. It was only later that I started reading about sloth and torpor in the suttas. And one of my favorite stories, it's in the commentary somewhere, but it's a great story for anyone who feels bad about falling asleep during this retreat. That the Buddha was going into the forest with his attendant Ananda. And there on the edge of the forest they saw this monk sitting meditation. With his right hand over his left hand, thumbs touching, perfectly straight back, head slightly tilted, eyes closed, breathing in and out mindfully. A perfect posture. And the Buddha looked at him and turned to Ananda and said, "I'm worried about that monk." And sure enough, 2 weeks later, he disrobed and got married. But a couple of hours later, a short time later, the Buddha walked deep into the forest. And there he saw another monk sitting down meditating all over the place, nodding this way, nodding that way, really getting into the sloth and torpor, nodding all over the place. And the Buddha turned to Ananda and smiled. "I'm not worried about him." And 2 weeks later, he became enlightened, an arahat with all the psychic powers. So anyone here who's having trouble with sloth and torpor, soon you're going to have all the psychic powers before you light. And of course, when I read something like that, it was counterintuitive. What's going on? Surely that first monk is a perfect monk, not that other sort of lazy slob. But now if you understand what's going on. The first monk was controlling. Was holding his breath, holding his mind, holding his body so forcefully. That control would never give him peace. And soon he'd have to leave the monastic order. And I knew a monk like that, a French monk, which, just a short time, he ordained a short time after I did. And now when he disrobed, he gave me his bowl. I've still got his bowl. You see that when I go on alms round today. And he was just always sitting so straight. Hardly spoke. Sometimes he would sit up like that all night. But he disrobed after 3.5 years as a monk. And when we asked him, "What did you disrobe before? We thought you were almost like enlightened." And he said, "No." He said, "I would hold my body straight like that all night and it would just hurt so much." He said every now and again he'd open his eyes and see monks like me nodding. And he was so jealous. He said, "If only I could do that and fall asleep." He never had any peace at all. He was a control freak, and he suffered so much as a result. And that made a big impact on me, because I only saw what was going on outside, the perfect monk. I never realized why he was perfect on the outside, because he was struggling so hard on the inside. So it's more important that you're at peace with your sloth and torpor than you're struggling keeping your body straight. When you learn how to let go, the sloth and torpor doesn't last long. It's the result of old karma. You're tired. So make peace with it. Don't expend energy on trying to stop this sloth and torpor. Make peace with it. Be kind to it. Be gentle with it. And then the old karma just fades away. And when you wake up, you are peaceful. If you struggle with these things, after when you wake up, when you come out of sloth and torpor, you're restless. You're tense. But if you just make peace with it, old karma, just what the body has to do, what the mind has to do, that's okay with me. Just like a demon, sloth and torpor demon, be kind to it, don't make war with it. Don't say, "Get out of here, you don't belong." It does belong, that's why it's there. It's karma, that's all. So make peace with it, and after a while it just fades away. And when it does fade away, because you've been making peace with it, you've got peace left. Meditation is like the house of peace. and you don't make peace with war, if you make war on your body and your mind, be aggressive and be violent, you're not going to get any peace at all. You just can get destruction, collateral damage, wounds. So throughout the meditation, just a great rule of thumb, whatever you're experiencing, make peace with it. Whatever you're experiencing, make peace, make peace, make peace, make peace, make peace, make peace, make peace. And then there's only one possibility. If you make so many moments of peace, you will be peaceful. You created the karmic causes for peace. And when you're meditating, you make peace with the breath, and it stays. You make peace with the nimitta, and it stays. And jhanas just happen. Jhanas are the result of letting go. They're not the result of striving. Jhanas are good karma, the result of many, many moments of letting go of the doer and just allowing knowing to happen, of being passive, of allowing the traveller to disappear. So there is just a path with no one walking on that path, no one doing anything, just knowing. So that is how to overcome problems. I mentioned basically the five hindrances. I didn't want about desire is also sensory desire, any sort of desire, wanting something is always a result of fault finding. It's just the other half of ill will. You know, I want something else. You know, when you're not happy where you are, you know, you want your lunch. You know, you sort of go to the kitchen and smell to see what's for lunch today. You know, you start thinking about things you want to do and fantasizing. It's all just desire. What are you doing that for? It's just you're not happy where you are. When you're happy where you are, no fault finding, then you're at peace. You don't have desires, you don't have ill will. Restlessness doesn't come up. Sloth and torpor, you just allow it just to pass away. And the last of those hindrances is doubt. The only way to overcome doubt is through experience. That's why I encourage people, if you don't agree with what I say, just try it out, try another way. Trial and error is by far the best way of overcoming doubt, getting experience. So that's the only way I could overcome doubt, even though I had a great teacher like Ajahn Chah. I didn't believe what he said. No way would I believe that sort of rubbish about, you know, just put your hand out and a mango will fall, like I said yesterday. That's stupid. You know, you've got to do something if you want a mango. Not like those lazy northeast Thais or those Laos I said yesterday. You know, just do something. Come on. And because that's the way I was trained, I never understood that. But over many, many years, you understand just how, from trial and error, just how profound that teaching is. The mango trees are in this retreat center also, fully laden with the ripest of mangoes. So please stop climbing the tree. Stop shaking it. Put your hand out and wait. And a juicy mango will fall, but only when you're not doing anything. So that's the way to meditate and overcome the problems. Basically, no fault finding. This is good enough. Gratitude. Making peace. Demon in the Emperor's palace. Through kindness, it disappears. All the problems, defilements, cravings, stuff going on in your head. Thank you for coming to visit me. Psychosis. And then it goes, disappears. Okay, so that's how to solve the problems in meditation. Any questions about this? Any comments, questions, any thoughts you found in my talk today? Okay, you got your hand up just before Tom. Rod.
You mentioned that for women, to love the breath is easy because they love the smelly, ugly, crying baby. Men use, like men love beer, don't they?
Love beer, like cricket. I'm not sure what else I'm about to love. I'm not going to follow that question. No. their favourite monk. Yeah, no, it's just a similar that you can't even like football, which creates so much suffering. Sort of, you can love that and spend. So the breath is much nicer than football, you know, because it's always a winner every time. So football can drive people crazy sometimes. You know, I still remember when I was a school teacher, and I was for 1 year before I became a monk, and there was like the World Cup soccer was on in that year. And I still remember that I think England soccer team were playing Poland. And they needed to win to go to the next round, the finals. And, you know, I watched the game as well. I was only sort of 20, 21, 22 or something on the TV. And, you know, England just, they hit the post, they got penalties disallowed, and they only drew 1-1. And the next day at the school, every kid and teacher was depressed. There was no discipline problems at all in the school because the kids had their head down, they were miserable. They didn't have enough energy to play around and be naughty. And even in the staff room, all the teachers, even the women as well, were all depressed. And it was a crazy thing to sort of allow one football match to spoil your day. When I sort of actually saw that, I thought, right, people take this far too seriously. Now, why allow yourself to get unhappy just because of a football match or a cricket match or something? So it just makes no sense to me at all. So you can watch the cricket or watch the football, but I think I mentioned to someone yesterday when I asked them, because they were Sri Lanka living in Australia. Okay, in the World Cup, who are you supporting, Australia or Sri Lanka? Are you really Australian or what? And of course they said, well, they did what I did. They wait till about, you know, see who's winning. Half time. And the one who's winning, that's the one they support. Now that's really wise, I think. Because that's really wise, because they have much more fun that way. When you've got a dual passport, like I've got a British passport and also a Australian passport, but I'm a Buddhist as well. So, you know, if the Sri Lankan team win, I'll support the Sri Lankans, because, you know, they're Buddhist. If the English are winning, yeah, I'll support the English, because that's where I was born. If the Australians are doing well, yeah, you know, up the Aussies, because, you know, I'm in Australia. So, you know, I've got three more times possibility of having fun than other people have. that's my philosophy for enjoying life. So anyway, I don't know if that answered your question, but I think I skirted it quite skillfully. Yeah, okay, no, I don't. Tom, you got a question before I get in more trouble.
I just wonder if the doer and will, is that the same?
Yeah, the doer and the will is the same thing. Because this is actually where you're subduing the will, calming yourself down. That's the opposite of letting go, is willing things to happen. Is let go of will. And the thing is that if you really let go of will, you don't just wander all over the place. If you really let go of will, because there's nothing driving your vehicle, driving your boat, it stops. It's like turning the engine off. It sort of goes a little way, but then it sort of runs out of energy and just stops. So, not just will, there's a Buddha called craving. So you're just letting go of craving. There's no craving left, nothing to do. And you become still. The problem is, though, the more you let go of the craving and the will, the more you don't exist. And that's a problem because people want to do things just to show they're still here. That's why kids misbehave in class. They say, you know, I'm still here. I'm not just an automaton, a robot who does what they're told. That's why people rebel. And I still remember this nun. This American nun, in the early years, we had all these rules, and being American, she felt so constrained by all the rules of being like in the monastery as a nun. And what she used to do to rebel, in that monastery, whenever you took a drink, you had to sit down to take a drink, or at least squat down. You weren't allowed to stand up and take a drink. And remember, she confided, she said, you know what I did today? She said, I stood up in my hut and I drank standing up. that was a symbol of rebellion. And why she did that? Because, you know, she wanted to exist and be herself and be different. So, you know, the will and craving actually comes from this wanting to be. So that's why I say the more there's less traveller on the path, the less you need to will. And where you can let go. That's why when the ego starts to disappear, the mind becomes much more peaceful. You don't need to control, you don't need to stand out, you don't need to be the special person on the retreat. Oh, there's a question over there, person in here, yes? Yep.
Oh, sorry, I was wondering where strength fitted in this, in the sense of that you went for that period for a couple of years being tired all the time, but you continued to persevere. And you said now that you actually wouldn't have done that. But if you hadn't done that, would you be the same person that you are today? And then with us, we can have a choice of either meditating or not meditating. There are times we should and some times we shouldn't. But within that, there's perseverance, there's strength, and I'm thinking about where adversity fits in life, where we come up against adversity and we overcome it through whatever strength that we can find within ourselves. And it's kind of all in the mix there, and I just wonder where you think it fits.
Okay, I think you're asking about like strength of character. She'd always just let go and allow things to happen, or she'd sometimes fight, and when you fight you get sort of greater strength and a greater character or whatever. And sure, there is a time when you should actually put forth effort and strive. If there's something to do, then give it everything you've got. But so often the fault with human beings that it's best if they did nothing and they just let it go. People strive too much, and that's all they know, how to strive and how to conquer things. And because of that, they get frustrated and they get depressed. Because it's just an observation that because people always try and control, the people who are very successful in life, you know, because control has worked for them up to a point, they always get to a brick wall sooner or later. Where just they can't influence the world anymore. And they don't give up easily. They get frustration, they get anger, and then they get depressed. That's usually the sequence of things. Control freaks, frustration, anger, and then depressed. They just give up. Not in the way, the positive way of meditation. They just, what's the point? And they just don't put any energy in it anymore. They've expended so much, they've got nothing left. So it's important to know where to spend one's energy, where one can be sort of not successful but influential, where one can influence things. A lot of times we can't. And here, if there was something I could do with Sloth and Torpor, fine. But really it was a lost cause. I should have just relaxed and rested. Just like even here, there's sometimes somebody mentioned you can spend a whole afternoon fighting with Sloth and Torpor. Battling it. And you may get in. You may get through it by the end of the evening. But another person has Sloth and Torpor, they go to their room and they take a nap for half an hour. And it's finished. And then they can go and meditate so peacefully the rest of the day. Which one should you do? To me it's quite obvious. Take the nap. Half an hour and afterwards Sloth and Torpor have gone. Instead of fight. So it's strategies. And it's true that sometimes you have to work hard. But meditation is not that type. You're working hard all your life. Now you have to learn the other half of life, how to make peace with things. How to leave things alone and watch them change by themselves. And that really gives you another strength. The strength of acceptance rather than fault finding. So you had the last question, yeah?
So you said that to do like the breathing, just the breath do the breathing and sit back and watch.
Yeah.
I tried to do that, so I don't count anymore. I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And then I realized that to do that by just watching my breath, I'm actually feeling my breath.
Good.
I'm interfering.
Oh, you're sure you'll always will interfere. You're asking, you're saying for the tape, that instead of counting the breath, you were just feeling the breath. And when you're feeling the breath, are you interfering with it? You will interfere with it at the very beginning, but after a while, you'll learn how to experience the breath, to feel it, without interfering with it. You just allow it to be. It will settle down. And you know you're not interfering with it when it becomes very gentle and peaceful, like a natural breath. But it takes a little while before it can go back to that natural breath. It's like, you know, when somebody's looking at you, you think, oh, he's looking at me, what should I do? And you don't, you know, you get a bit tense. But after a while, you just relax. Apparently, there's all these CCTV cameras in some city centres now. You know, in the malls and around the front of the shops. And at first, people would be very tense if someone's looking at them. But now, apparently, they just relax and they just don't even bother. They're natural again. And the same, apparently, the reality TV shows. That you think, wow, you know, if someone was having a TV camera on you, if we had, like, this retreat centre, like a reality TV centre, no, not Big Brother, what should we call it? Big Meditator. Then at first you'd be really tense. Wow, you know, the whole world is watching me, the whole of Australia, I'm on TV. And you think you'd tense up, which you probably would do the first hour or two, but then you just relax and just act normally, apparently. So after a while, you know, when the breath realizes it's being watched, yeah, but so what? And then it relaxes. It's natural again. So it's true, when you first feel the breath, you do interfere with it. But after a while, it just relaxes and gets normal. Okay, so that's enough for the talk. So happy meditating. And remember to see how much you can disappear.